Welcome back to the Deep Dive. Today, we're going way back, like ancient India, way back to the late Vedic period, roughly 1000 to 500 BCE.
It's really fascinating. This era is it's like the foundation for so many big ideas in Indian thought.
Yeah, I know. And you've given us some really incredible sources to work with. So I guess our mission today is
We're talking about what comes later, and it's a time of tremendous change. I mean, imagine, Vedic society. They were primarily focused on rituals and sacrifices. But then things started to shift. You had this rise of urbanization, new kingdoms popping up, a growing merchant class.
So like any time of upheaval, things start to get shaken up a bit. People start asking like the big questions.
The old ways of thinking and doing things, they just didn't seem to fit anymore.
And what I think is really interesting is how this period saw a change in how people thought about Dharma. It became less about just following rituals blindly and more about something deeper.
Absolutely. It's like Dharma got an upgrade. Instead of just focusing on those outward actions and rituals, thinkers started to explore the inner ethical core of Dharma. It became more about cultivating virtues like honesty, nonviolence, self-control.
So it's almost like a shift from, doing the right thing to being the right kind of person, like your character.
That's a great way to put it. And this shift wasn't just theoretical, it had real-world implications.
Oh, I bet. Give me an example.
Okay, so think about the growing merchant class. This was a new phenomenon in Vedic society. Suddenly, you had people accumulating wealth through trade. And this raised all sorts of ethical questions, like, was it ethical to profit from trade, What were the limits of accumulating wealth?
It's like a whole new set of problems.
Exactly. And these questions forced people to really grapple with the essence of right action in a changing world.
So Dharma is getting more complex. It's becoming less about blind obedience and more about individual moral responsibility. I like it. It's like an ethical evolution.
It is. And at the same time that all this was happening with Dharma, people were also starting to grapple with the very nature of the self, the Atman.
Oh yeah, the Atman. This is where things start to get really, really mind-bending, right?
Oh, absolutely. The late Vedic period saw some truly groundbreaking ideas about the self emerge. Well, thinkers began to question, is the self, the Atman, is it separate from the body? Or is it something more universal, something that connects all
Oh
beings?
wow. It's like they were wrestling with the same questions that we still find so fascinating today. Who are we really? What happens after we die? Is there a part of us that lives on?
Precisely. And some of the answers they came up with were, well, they were revolutionary. For instance, the idea that the individual self, the Atman, is ultimately identical to Brahman.
Brahman.
Yes. The ultimate reality or the cosmic principle.
Well, okay, hold on. So they're saying that deep down we're all connected to this universal essence. That's a big idea.
It is, and it's an idea that would have a profound impact on later Indian philosophy and spirituality, especially in the Upanishads.
Yeah, I can see that.
It challenges us to look beyond our individual identities and to see ourselves as part of something much, much larger.
Okay, so we've got evolving ideas about Dharma, this deep dive into the nature of the self. What else were these late Vedic thinkers pondering, aside from all that?
Well, they were also thinking about the entire universe and how it works. You see, alongside these debates about Dharma and the self, there was also this growing interest in understanding the cosmic order. People were moving away from just performing rituals to please the gods, and they were trying to grasp the underlying principles that governed reality.
So they wanted to understand the why behind the what.
Exactly. It wasn't just about what rituals do we do, it was about what's the force behind it all.
Makes sense.
And so they started asking questions like, what is the nature of reality? What is the role of the divine? What are the laws that govern the universe?
Oh, wow. It's like they were trying to like crack the cosmic code.
It is. It really is like that. And it's amazing how all these big questions were swirling around at the same time.
So was there any like connection between how they viewed the self, Dharma, and this cosmic order? Or were these like totally separate lines of inquiry?
No, that's what's so fascinating about this period. All these ideas were interconnected.
Oh, interesting.
For instance, some thinkers started to see Dharma as an expression of the cosmic order. They argued that living ethically, it wasn't just about being a good person, but it was about aligning yourself with the fundamental laws of the universe.
So it's like, it's not just about being good for the sake of being good. It's because it's somehow woven into the very fabric of reality.
Yes, exactly.
That's powerful. I can really see how this period was like setting the stage for those even more radical ideas we find in the Upanishads.
It was. The late Vedic period was like this philosophical pressure cooker where all these ideas were simmering and evolving, just getting ready to burst onto the scene.
This is already blowing my mind.
Yeah.
Okay, so we've got this incredible intellectual ferment happening. But what did these ideas actually look like in practice? Like, how did they change how people live their lives? Did they have any real-world impact?
That's a great question. And to understand that, we need to take a closer look at some of the key texts from this era. Let's start with the Brahmanas and the Aranyakas.
Okay, so we're going even deeper into the late Vedic world. I'm ready to dive into those texts and see how these abstract ideas actually played out.
Well, what's fascinating about the Brahmanas is that they give us a glimpse into this evolving role of rituals.
Wait, rituals? I thought we were moving away from the ritualistic focus of the earlier Vedic period.
We are, but it's not a clean break. The Brahmanas, they don't completely abandon rituals. Instead, they start to interpret them differently.
Okay, so it's not just about going through the motions anymore.
No. They become less about pleasing the gods and more about exploring their deeper symbolic meaning.
So it's like the rituals themselves become a kind of philosophical exploration.
Exactly. They become a way to contemplate the nature of the cosmos, the role of the divine, even the relationship between the human and the divine.
That's a pretty big shift. So Instead of just like mechanically going through the motions, these rituals become more about like reflection and inner transformation.
Precisely. And this shift, it becomes even more pronounced in the Aranyakas, which literally means forest treatises.
Forest treatises. Okay, why forest?
Well, because the Aranyakas, they reflect this growing trend of individuals retreating to the forests for contemplation and spiritual practice.
So it's like the ancient Indian version of going off the grid, finding enlightenment in nature.
You could say that. The Aranyakas, they delve even deeper into philosophical and mystical themes, exploring the nature of reality, the self, the ultimate goal of human existence.
Sounds intense.
It is. And it really does sound like these texts are getting us closer and closer to that kind of abstract introspective thinking that we associate with the Upanishads.
You do. It's like they're the bridge between the ritualistic world of the earlier Vedas and the more philosophical world of the Upanishads.
Yes. Yeah.
Okay, so we've gone from elaborate rituals to exploring their deeper meaning, to retreating to the forests for contemplation. It sounds like the late Vedic period was a time of like intense spiritual searching. But did this have any impact on how society as a whole functioned? Like, did it change things on a larger scale?
It did. It really did. These shifts in thought, they weren't just happening in isolation. They had a ripple effect on social and political structures, too.
So how did this philosophical ferment, you know, how did it change the landscape of ancient India?
Well, for starters, it contributed to the emergence of new forms of social organization.
All right, I'm ready for that deep dive. Let's get into it.
You know, it's interesting thinking back to like that shift we were talking about from those outward rituals to that inward transformation.
Yeah, yeah.
Well, that shift had this huge impact on how society itself was structured. We start to see the rise of, you know, what are known as Shramanas.
Shramanas. Okay, I'm not familiar with that. What were they exactly?
Yeah.
Like some kind of social group,
Yeah, think of them as seekers, wanderers, people who renounced worldly attachments to really focus on spiritual liberation. And they challenged those traditional hierarchies that were based on, you know.
Oh, the caste system.
Yes, yeah. Based on birth and ritual purity and all that.
So were they kind of like the counterculture movement of ancient India?
Mm-hmm.
Like the establishment, you know, forging their own path? Like, is that a fair comparison?
That's a great analogy. Yeah. The Shramanas, they came from all walks of life. You had priests, you had warriors, even merchants. And they lived these very simple lives, you know? They meditated, they debated philosophical ideas.
It sounds like a pretty radical departure from the norm.
It was.
I mean, how do people react to these shramanas? Like, was it welcomed? Was it?
It was definitely disruptive. I mean, some people they saw them as wise teachers, you know.
Yeah.
But others viewed them with a lot of suspicion as this threat to the established way of life, and this tension between those who clung to those traditional norms and those who were seeking new paths to truth. Well, that would become a recurring theme in Indian history.
Yeah, I mean, it's amazing how these like philosophical ideas could shake up the very foundations of a society. It's fascinating. And it's also like really interesting to me how this period, you know, set the stage for the rise of new religious movements, you know, like Buddhism and Jainism.
Right, right. And the Shramanas were really instrumental in paving the way for these new faiths. I mean, you think about it, the Buddha himself, he was a Shramana before he attained enlightenment.
Oh, right, right.
He rejected the rigid caste system, and he emphasized, you know, personal experience and ethical conduct as the path to liberation.
So we're seeing this direct link between that intellectual ferment of the late Vedic period and then those spiritual revolutions that followed.
Exactly. Yeah. And Jainism too, with its emphasis on nonviolence and self-discipline, that also emerged from this from the Shramana tradition. Both Buddhism and Jainism, they challenged the authority of the Vedas, and they offered these alternative paths to spiritual fulfillment.
Wow. So the late Vedic period was like a philosophical big bang, you know? So many ideas just exploding outwards, reshaping the spiritual and the social landscape. It's incredible. Did this period, did it leave us with any written works, any texts that give us like a more direct window into these debates that were happening?
It did. And this is where the Upanishads come in. They're like the culmination of the late Vedic period. They're this collection of texts that really delve deep into the nature of reality, the self, and the ultimate goal of human existence.
So if the Brahmanas and the Aranyakas were like the bridge, then the Upanishads are the destination. Like, is that?
That's a great way to put it.
Okay.
Yeah, they're considered some of the most profound and influential texts in Indian thought, and they're still studied and debated today, which is amazing.
Wow. I can only imagine, you know, the kinds of mind-blowing ideas they must contain. Can you give us like a little taste of what we might find if we crack open the Upanishads?
Well, imagine, you know, these dialogues between teachers and students exploring questions like, you know, what is the self?
Yeah.
What happens after death? What is the nature of reality?
Yeah.
And they use all these metaphors and stories and logical arguments to really explore these profound themes.
It sounds like a philosophical treasure trove.
Yeah, it is. It is.
I'm definitely adding the Upanishads to my reading list.
You should.
But before we get lost in those ancient texts, I'm curious about, you know, how this period, how it influenced like later Indian philosophy. Did those later thinkers just like accept the Upanishadic ideas? Or did they challenge them? Did they reinterpret them?
That's what's so great about Indian philosophy. It's a it's a living tradition. You know, the ideas of the Upanishads, they didn't just sit there gathering dust.
Yeah.
They became the foundation for centuries of debate and interpretation.
So it was like an ongoing conversation.
It was. With each generation adding their own insights and perspectives.
I love it. It's like a philosophical relay race.
It is. And different schools of thought emerged, each offering their own take on the key concepts from the Upanishads.
Okay.
For example, the Samkhya school, they focused on the duality of matter and consciousness.
Okay.
While the Yoga school, they developed practices to achieve liberation through self-discipline and meditation.
So even within the broad framework of the Upanishads, there was still a lot of diversity of thought. Like people weren't just all on the same page.
Absolutely, yeah. There was a lot of debate, and this diversity, this is what makes Indian philosophy so rich and vibrant. It's not a monolithic system of beliefs. It's more like this dynamic tapestry of ideas constantly evolving and adapting.
I like that. That's a great image. It sounds like the late Vedic period really planted the seeds for this incredible intellectual ecosystem that would just like flourish for centuries.
Yeah.
But what about the political landscape? Yeah. Now, was all this philosophical change just happening in a vacuum, or did it also influence the way that ancient India was governed?
That's a crucial question, because because philosophy and politics are rarely separate. And in the case of the late Vedic period, these intellectual shifts, they had a significant impact on the emergence of new political ideas and institutions.
So how did those philosophical debates, you know, about Dharma and the cosmos and all that, how did they translate into the, you know, into the real world arena of power and governance?
Well, one of the most significant developments was the rise of what's known as the Janapada system.
Janapada, okay, new word for me.
Yeah.
What's that? Yeah. Some kind of political structure.
Essentially, yes. Yeah. The Janapadas, they were territorial units, like small kingdoms or city states, yeah, that emerged during this period. And they challenged those older tribal structures. And right. And they really paved the way for the rise of larger empires.
So we're seeing a shift from those smaller, more kinship based societies to more complex, you know, territorial states.
Precisely, yeah. And this shift, it was influenced by the philosophical debates of the time.
Yeah.
You know, the concept of Dharma with its emphasis on righteous conduct and social order, that played a key role in legitimizing the authority of rulers,
yeah,
and shaping the laws and institutions of these emerging states.
So Dharma wasn't just a personal code of ethics anymore. It was also becoming a political principle.
Right? Exactly. Yeah. It was used to define the duties of rulers, the rights of citizens, and just the overall framework for a just and harmonious society.
That's fascinating. So the same ideas that were prompting, you know, individuals to question their place in the universe.
Yeah.
They were also shaping the political structures that govern their lives.
Yeah. That's the beauty of this period. The personal and the political were totally intertwined. You know,
yeah,
the quest for spiritual liberation and the quest for a just and harmonious society were seen as two sides of the same coin.
Okay, so we've got these Janapadas emerging,
yeah,
with Dharma as this guiding principle. But did this lead to any specific forms of government? Were they monarchies? Were they republics? Or something else?
Well, that's where things get even more interesting. The late Vedic period, it saw this variety of political systems emerge.
All right, let's get into that. So yeah, like a real mix of political models, huh? Not like a one-size-fits-all situation.
Nope, not at all. Some of those Janapadas were monarchies, you know, with a king in charge.
Right, right.
While others developed like these more oligarchic systems where power was kind of shared among a group of elites.
I see.
And get this, there were even some that resembled, you know, early republics.
Republics, wow. Okay, hold on. Republics in ancient India, that's not something you hear about every day.
I know. It's pretty amazing.
What were those like? Give me the details.
Well, they were really fascinating experiments in self-governance.
Okay.
For example, you had the Vajjin Confederacy.
The Vajjin Confederacy.
Yeah. They were located in what's now Bihar in India.
Okay.
And they had this system where leaders were chosen through this whole process of debate and consensus building.
Mm-hmm.
They even had like a kind of constitution, a set of rules and principles that guided their decision making.
Pretty cool, huh? So like ancient Indian democracy in action.
Pretty much.
Wow. Makes,
yeah,
you wonder if there are like any connections between those early republics and the later development of democratic ideas in
yeah,
India.
That's a great question. And it's something that scholars are still kind of exploring, but it's fascinating to see how those seeds of self-governance, you know, were sown so early in Indian history.
Yeah. And all this was happening alongside those big philosophical shifts we've been talking about. It's like ancient India was this laboratory for new ideas, both spiritual and political.
It really was.
So, yeah. So did this period of experimentation and innovation, did it eventually lead to the rise of larger empires?
Yeah.
You know, like as those Janapadas grew and got more powerful.
It did. As the Janapadas grew in power and influence, they inevitably started clashing with each other.
Right. Classic power struggles.
Yeah. And some ambitious rulers emerged, you know, guys who are looking to expand their territories and really establish their dominance.
So it's like that classic story of small states, you know, consolidating into larger empires.
Exactly. And this process, it culminated in the rise of the Magadha Empire, which became one of the most powerful empires in ancient India.
Magadha. Oh, yeah.
Yeah.
Magadha. Weren't they the ones who went up against Alexander the Great? Like, weren't they his rivals?
That's right. The Magadha Empire under the Nandas and then later the Mauryas.
Okay.
They controlled a vast, vast swath of northern India.
Yeah.
They had this really sophisticated administrative system.
Yeah.
A powerful army and just a flourishing economy.
Yeah.
They were a force to be reckoned with.
So they weren't messing around. They were the real deal.
Oh, yeah. And their rise to power, it really marked this turning point in Indian history.
Okay.
It set the stage for the emergence of a unified Indian subcontinent under the Mauryan Emperor Ashoka.
Ashoka, yeah.
Who famously embraced Buddhism and really promoted peace and nonviolence throughout his realm.
Wow. What a journey. We've gone from those early philosophical stirrings of the late Vedic period all the way to the rise and fall of empires. It's incredible to think how those early debates about Dharma and the self and the cosmos, mm. how they had such a huge impact mm-hmm. on the course of Indian history.
It really is. It's a reminder that ideas have power. You know, they can shape not just individual lives but entire civilizations.
I think that's a perfect note to end on. Thanks for taking us on this deep dive into the late Vedic period. It's been truly eye-opening.
My pleasure. It's always fascinating to revisit this period and see how it continues to resonate with us even today.
It does. It really does. And for our listeners, if you're feeling inspired to learn more,
yeah.
why not dive into the Upanishads yourselves?
Yeah.
You might be surprised by how relevant those ancient texts still feel, you know, even thousands of years later. Until next time, keep exploring.